that's a way of having a joined up policy and transforming from where we are now to having an extra 100,000 apartments in Dublin or 200,000. And that's probably the number, incidentally, and it's achievable within 3 to 5 years.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Entrepreneur Experiment podcast with me, Gary Fox. This is the first episode in season 12, and we've got an absolute banger. This is Fergal Brady. He's the co-founder of No Friction, but this is not his first venture. Fergal sold his first company, Blueface, to one of the world's biggest companies, Comcast. In this episode, you're going to learn three key things. What is a triple bottom line? How to turn your weaknesses into a strength? And what Fergal would do if he ran Ireland for a year? Here is my episode with Fergal Brady. First, quick thank you to our partners. Thanks to my partner, Square. Everything your business needs, like payments, point of sale, e-commerce, inventory management, chatting endlessly about the weather? Well, you're on your own there. Square. Everything your business needs. Almost. Visit square.com. Fergal, welcome to the pod.
Hello. Nice to be here.
The very first pod of 2023, so forgive me if I'm a bit rusty.
And my first pod. So.
First pod ever. Okay.
Well, close enough to it, yeah.
Okay, okay. I feel special.
Yeah.
Me too. Where you've kind of an unusual journey of where you've actually physically come from. Today, I think we'll start with that. We could have done this in a number of city locations across Europe.
Yeah, I've been living in a few different cities in Europe for the last, I don't know how long. I've traveled quite a lot all my life, actually. So I lived for a long time in Singapore, and I lived in Paris as well. I studied there, lived in Rome and Florence. And I spend a good bit of the year now in Madrid. So I came in from Madrid yesterday.
I think you'd have figured out for others. I think you figured this out. This is the new thing, right? We suddenly in COVID, everyone thinks, wait, yeah. I can not live in Ireland and work somewhere else and still get paid I can work here some of the year.
Yeah. Well, I like working here and I like coming here and so on, but I like exploring other countries and so on. But I like living in Madrid, I have to say. I found Madrid about 3.5 years ago, and it's a fantastic city to live in. Really, really nice. So I come back here and I stay here like 4 or 5 days a week. And I go home on a Friday evening or Thursday evening sometimes.
So when I met you, I complained about my commute from Wicklow.
Yeah, it's probably a similar amount of time.
It probably is.
Yeah, it's only really about 2 hours, you know, on the plane. Although we did have a discussion about taking the ferry. So there's a Bilbao Rosslare ferry. So it's 4 hours from Madrid up to Bilbao.
Okay.
Of a drive, and then it's about 30 odd hours on the ferry.
Yeah, that's chunky. I'll let you know. We're going to do that in October. Yeah. So I'll let you know. We'll have a part two. We might do a part two in Madrid next year in October.
Yeah.
So what brought you to Madrid?
It's a long story.
Oh, yeah. We've got an hour, yeah. So we got to fill it somehow.
Yeah. Well, back in the Blueface days, so Blueface, the first main company, I suppose, we started. We acquired a business in Italy. I think it would have been back in about 2012. As a small Italian company that was actually set up by a couple of guys that I'd known, and they'd grown it a little bit, but not a huge amount. And we wanted to have a European presence, so we acquired it, and I moved to Italy as part of that. So I lived in Rome and in Florence. So the office was in Rome. It was in Roma Termini. I'm not sure if anybody knows the main train station in Rome. It's this fantastic building. It was built by Mussolini in the 30s, during a time when marble was clearly free. So the entire interior is kitted out wall to wall in marble.
And that's where your office was?
The office was then there, yeah. So there's this fantastic accelerator, incubator, stroke investment company. It's called Lewis N Labs, and they've built one of the biggest accelerators in Southern Europe. In collaboration with one of the universities there, Lewis. So they built out the area. Roma Termini is obviously owned by the Grande Stazione, the company who manages all the train stations in Italy, and it's very oldy-worldy. So you've got little post boxes where they put in all the details for all the trains running around Italy all the time.
Nice.
Running out of Termini, yeah. So it's two spurs on either side of, I think, 26 tracks in the middle, and the Grand Concourse, you know, spanning across them. And each spur on either side is about a kilometer long. And there are these huge, huge buildings, massive ceilings. And I think there's about four stories. So Lewis Enlabs took one of the floors, put in sort of false floor to protect the original flooring. And they've got a co-working space. They have an investment arm which invests in startups. So there's this amazing... there's this amazing sort of contrast between walking into that and having this sort of ultra modern working space with all these, you know, high tech startups in Roma Termini. And then you look outside and there's all the sort of, you know, slow decaying opulence of Rome and all the 1,000-year-old buildings all around. It's really, really interesting contrast. So anyway, our office was based there for many years, and I lived in Rome and just really like enjoyed the continental lifestyle. So we ended up moving to Madrid about 3.5 years ago. We went there for about a month. Really, really liked it. Beautiful city, fantastic weather, really, really nice people, incredibly efficient, clean, safe city, great climate, great way of life, and just really enjoyed it and decided, yeah, this would be a nice place to stay. So we stayed. And then we started another business in Ireland, so I've been commuting back and forth. Yeah.
All makes sense to me. Yeah. I think that's the new world, right? Yeah, I think that's, if I'm honest, I'm bullish on that new world, that way of living whereby it's balance. You're not tied to places or things. It's a fluid world whereby you have options. And I think as entrepreneurs, we probably crave that anyway. We want that flexibility, if not been tied down. You mentioned your company there, Blueface. What was that?
Blueface was an IP telephony company. It started out, the technology was known as voice over IP. It probably started out in the late 90s. Those people who remember the late 90s and the dot-com boom and so on, the idea of being able to make a phone call over an internet connection started gaining traction, mainly among techies, because generally speaking, you connected to the internet over your phone line. So it was pretty pointless making a phone call over the internet when you're connected via the phone line and in the first place. But by the sort of the early 2000s, it had begun to mature a little bit and broadband connections became more prevalent. So I'd finished an MBA in HEC in Paris, HEC Paris, and I'd set out with the goal there of deciding on what business I'd start. And I toyed with the idea of setting up a wireless broadband business where you deliver broadband wirelessly, which is reasonably common now. But back then it was kind of innovative, and voice over IP and wireless broadband kind of went hand in hand because you didn't need to have a phone line to get an internet connection. And so if you wanted to make phone calls, this would be the ideal solution. So when I came back from the MBA, came back to Ireland, and I came across my business partner, Aaron Clawson. So Aaron's this incredible Australian software engineer who'd been working in Intel, and he'd been working on a telephony billing platform for Intel. And he had a wireless broadband service in his house here in Dublin, and he didn't want to pay line rental at €25 a month. And he decided, well, he'd sort of build a platform so he could make phone calls over the internet. And so he started investigating and exploring it and built a platform.
How did you find him? Because that's what people are always like, oh, where do I get a co-founder? Do I want a co-founder? Where is it?
Exactly, yeah. And it was really important. Actually, it's still incredibly important. He's the technical co-founder, a brilliant engineer, and I went looking on boards.ie.
I love boards. I grew up on boards.
Yeah. Boards is I haven't engaged with it in quite some time.
It's still flying.
I went
back recently. I was trying to buy a PlayStation 5 during lockdown.
Okay.
And I was like, where are they? They were completely sold out everywhere. You could not get one.
Yeah.
And I was like, I know.
Boards. Now you're talking.
And it worked. Right, yeah. I was on boards every day. Yeah. I had all the alerts set up, and I was just sitting there every day at like 8 o'clock waiting to see where the restock was.
Yeah.
Ended up getting them in this random DID electrical in Still Organ.
Brilliant.
And we got five in.
Yeah.
We got five in.
You're up there.
I'll be there in 5 minutes.
Yeah.
It was amazing.
Yeah. So that's I started looking. There was a piece of open source software called Asterix, and I started investigating it and came across lots of different forums, and Aaron had been engaging in one of them. So I got in touch with him and we started talking and decided, seems like a good idea. He was still working for Intel. I was just coming back from the MBA, as I said, hadn't started working.
When you did the MBA, Why did you do it? Was that with the intention of, I'm going to figure out a business idea, or what was the reason?
That's a good question.
It was in Paris. It sounded cool.
Yeah. Well, I studied mechanical engineering, and when I left that, I worked for a engineering manpower leasing company. So what we did was we hired engineers to go and build power plants, cement plants, etc., around the world, and effectively subcontracted them to some of the large contractors, contracting companies. So I was working in that, and then I decided I wanted to do a bit more travel, and I wanted to get into IT. It was the dot-com boom, you know, and everyone wanted to jump in that bandwagon. And I found a company called CR2, which is an internet banking software company, which is still going. And it was founded by Kian and Ron, who'd worked for Kindle Banking Systems. Kindle Banking Systems was probably, to the best of my knowledge, the first global Irish software company, and hardly anyone has ever heard of it, and their platforms are still in operation all around the world. It's an extraordinarily successful company. And Kian, who was the principal software engineer and architect, built one of the first LAN-based, in other words, distributed banking back office systems. And Kindle went out and sold that platform around the world. I think it was bought by Mysis, or one of the other banking software companies, in the end. But they decided to set up a new company. So CR2 stood for Kian and Ron second time around.
No way.
And they set up, so the idea was to sell internet banking software to banks to enable them to put their, you know, accounting platform, or their accounts and services online, enable people to log in and do their own transactions and so on. So I joined them. As a pre-sales technical engineer, got into the more the salesy end of it, and they sent me out to Singapore. So I was commuting out and back to Singapore for about 2 years. Yeah, so going out for 2 or 3 weeks at a time.
Really,
commuting all around South Asia. From Hong Kong, Philippines, Taiwan.
Selling in the solution, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Around India, Sri Lanka, etc. Yeah, exactly.
I'd imagine that hones your sales skills pretty quickly.
Yeah, I suppose. Yeah. And gave me great insight into lots of things. One was the startup world, the startup environment, the excitement of it, the energy of it, the pace of it, the kind of people that you needed. I began to observe all the sort of ingredients you needed to make a company like this work. And it grew really, really quickly. A lot of investment. I think there might have been 140 people, something like that, at one stage. It was very, very big. They acquired a business in the UK and sort of branched out a little bit. So that's how I ended up going out to Singapore, and then the dot bust happened. And they wanted me to come back to Dublin, and I wasn't that keen on leaving my tax-free salary, or effectively tax-free salary, in my swimming pool and my paid-for apartment in Singapore.
I'm seeing where the travel bug came from. I think we just traced it back there.
Yeah. So wasn't mad keen. So I came back to Dublin, and it was, you know, miserable and wet and grey, and I don't know about this now.
Yeah.
And I'd been considering doing an MBA anyway. The MBA is kind of a traditional route for an engineer to move from engineering into sales. Although I'm a rubbish engineer, and I've never practiced engineering really, you know.
Okay. You know enough to be dangerous.
To be very dangerous. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I looked at all the different MBA schools and kind of picked out, well, okay, what are the top 5, top 10 business schools in Europe, and a few of the US ones. The US ones were just prohibitively expensive. I'm not an academic, so there's no way I was going to get a scholarship or anything like that. So I decided, okay, I looked at the cost of them, the rating of them, when they started and where they were, and HEC.
You took an engineer's view on this.
Yeah, I took an engineer's view and a pragmatic view, and I said, okay, it's 18 months. I think it was about €40,000 at the time, something like that.
Chunky.
Yeah, chunky enough, plus 18 months of not earning and sort of funding
living
yourself,
somewhere else.
You know, yeah.
Okay, so it was a big investment financially, and there's always that time investment.
And I just thought it would be a good way of figuring out what it was that I wanted to do and needed to do. And bear in mind, at this stage, I was 32, I think. So it was one of the older ones on the course. And I wanted to start my own business. And if not, I wanted to work for a, you know, great big company who'd send me out to Singapore and pay for my apartment.
You really had two sliding scales. And then you completed the other end of the thing. Yeah. I want to become like a founder with no money and I'm going to have to scrape it, or I want to be fabulously paid in Singapore.
Yeah. But realistically though, no, seriously, I knew I wanted to start my own business. And I'd had a few different kind of, you know, businesses over the years, despite my and not sort of starting a big business, but I had a few different ventures that I'd had. So I wanted to do something. I wanted to create a real business, something valuable, something constructive, something that would last and was valuable and useful and provided a service and was innovative and something in technology. And that's when I came back from Singapore, did the MBA, and figured out that, yeah, this sounds like the right thing to do, this wireless broadband and voice over IP. Met Aaron. We started Blueface with no money. A friend of mine that I worked for in the engineering firm, Des, who passed away this year, fortunately, he loaned us an office because he had two offices. He was in the middle of selling one. So he loaned us an office for 6 months. So we had the office. Aaron typically worked from home anyway. And we got sort of friends and family around. I think we raised about 150,000 euros, something like that. My former professor in HEC invested, which was a nice vote of confidence, I suppose. Des did, a few other people. So we raised some money. Enterprise Ireland were brilliant. DBIC as well were really good, very supportive. So we got some funds in, started building out the platform, started getting customers, and we grew really, really fast. So I think we must have been doing probably, you know, 100,000 euros a month in revenue, probably within about 12 months.
Wow.
To 15 months.
And what were you doing? Yeah. For anyone not familiar with this whole space, explain it to me like I'm a child, a smart child, but still a child.
Yeah.
What were you doing to get 100 grand?
So we sold a phone service. So typically back in those days, you paid line rental, which is like 25 euros a month. And then you paid for your calls. So every time you made a phone call, it's 20 cents. And if you called the US or something, that you got charged a euro a minute or something. So, you know, if you had a lot of international calls, you'd have a fairly hefty phone bill. So what we did is we provided a little box that you plugged your phone into that turned it into an internet phone. And you plugged that little box into your internet connection.
Okay.
So if you didn't get broadband over your phone line, if you got it through cable broadband or wireless broadband, then you cut out the 25 euros a month, which is a great saving. Mm-hmm. And then we were the first to introduce unlimited call plans, one of the first in Ireland and probably around the world, really, to introduce unlimited call plans. So as many calls as you like, and we just charge you 10 euros or 20 euros a month, whatever it was. And that's how we did it. And then we were actually quite a lot of activity on boards. So a lot of the people who started using the service, the early adopters, were typically techies. And they loved this from a technical point of view because they thought, this is cool. You can make phone calls over the internet and, whoa, hack the system. This is great.
It ticks all the boxes. Ticks for all people the boxes, on boards.
You know, So, so that's what we did. And it grew really fast. And then they started bringing it into companies. You know, say, oh, well, we could probably use this in our business.
This was my question for you, because a lot of companies are now going, we're going to be a product-led company. Yeah. And people are like, what's that?
It
means you build a product so good that the likes of me and you were going, nerds who were like, oh, it's a class, going to use it in my house. And then you're like, well, I'm going to bring it into our business
right. Yeah. Remind me to come back to that point, actually, because I think it's very important.
Okay.
So that's what we did. And of course, back in those days, internet was absolutely rubbish, internet access. And so there.
What year are we talking? Are we still going to.
2005.
Still doing the dial-up?
2005. Okay. It was prevalent, you know. But our primary target market were those people, residential users who had cable broadband, because wireless broadband was still a bit rubbish. So you all the time. But cable broadband was really good, really solid. And there was a grand total of 80,000 cable broadband customers in Ireland.
So how did you find that out?
Well, we did research, and the biggest cable broadband company in the country was, at the time, would have been NTL.
Yes.
Previously Cablevision and then Virgin and so on. So 80,000 was our primary target market, which is a ridiculously small primary target
market. But I love this, right? Because it's clearly identifiable. Mm. A lot of entrepreneurs are like, we're going to be all things to all people.
Mm.
And they just burn themselves out trying to target 2 million people when in reality, 80,000.
Yeah, That was it.
You know, at as niche as you can go.
It is. And at 10 to 20 euros a month.
You do the maths.
And of course, you're building out a platform. And from a technological point of view, this was really cutting edge.
Yeah.
So what we kind of did was, in a way, we hacked the system in that it was a very, very grey area around regulation, because telecoms obviously a very regulated area. Mm. And what we did was we took phone lines, you know, they're called PRIs, a bit technical. We took phone lines with phone numbers from some of the big telecoms wholesale companies, connected them up to a computer, and then provided those numbers, effectively subcontracted those numbers to our customers. So
a phone call
would come in to the big telecoms company, come into our computer, we'd send it down to the customer's computer or phone. And then it was a very grey area for regulation, but we recognised that we needed to get regulated. We needed to become a telco ourselves. We needed to get our own phone number range and so on.
Because then you weren't dependent on them, isn't it? They were the middleman. If they pulled that, you were screwed.
Exactly. Okay. And at one point it did happen, because Smart Telecom, which was one of our providers, effectively went bust, or close to went bust at one point. Anyway, they were turned off from Aircom, which was the state telephone company, effectively stopped delivering the phone calls into Smart Telecom, and we had numbers from Smart Telecom.
So the ripple effect down.
You know, a couple of thousand business customers who woke up in the morning and couldn't receive phone calls. Mm. So you can imagine the phone calls we were getting.
There's a great lesson there in that, though, in the fact of, what are you building your business on?
Yeah.
And are you building it on, is there a single point of failure that you do not control?
Yeah, exactly. And that was that and amongst other reasons, legislative, regulatory reasons, we knew we had to become a telco. So that requires a lot of investment, and it was extremely difficult to get investment in Ireland back then, sort of 2006, 2007. Mm. Credit crunch started happening. And in Ireland, at the time, if you weren't investing in property, nobody wanted to talk to you. Technology, that's for the birds. You know, that's nothing to do with us. We want to
buy two properties in Bulgaria off the back of the Sunday Independent, but I won't buy.
No, won't invest in tech companies. Yeah. So it was really, really hard. And we struggled to get investment, and we kind of plateaued in terms of revenue growth. So we're kind of maybe 2.5 million, we 20 people, something like that, by sort of 2009. Aaron was going back to Tasmania. His wife is Irish, but they were moving back there for a while. And he wasn't involved day to day in the business. So I wanted to bring in a new management team, new investment, and that's what we did. And then we grew it, and over the years, it, you know, increased the worldwide sort of focus. We had a white label platform, a wholesale platform we provided to other telcos. And then we merged with a US company, became the fourth largest of its kind in the world. And then the business was sold to Comcast, who now own it. So Blueface is still operating there. So that was the journey with Blueface. Really, really interesting. And having a technical co-founder was a fundamental key to the success of the whole project. Mm. But it was extremely intensive. The first 4 or 5 years were really, really, really hard. So up until 2010, 2011, things started to get, you know, improved. Then the investment environment became better. The businesses started taking off again, and the technology had matured substantially. And so it enabled us to target more businesses, to grow overseas, to acquire a company in Italy, to provide this global wholesale platform.
So timing is one of those things that we don't really talk about, because often it's with hindsight, you're like, oh, the time is just right.
Mm. Yeah.
You can't really plan it. Like, you can line up like you did in terms of, right, this is emerging technology, but equally you don't know how quickly that's going to emerge.
No.
It's like ChatGPT and AI at the minute. Everyone's all in a fluster over that. We don't really know how fast that's going to come, though. Mm. Mm. So it's kind of a punt until looking back, you can kind of go, well, the timing was tough in 2007, but then it was right in 2012.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And I suppose we were heavily focused on developing our own platform, and a lot of the open source software that was developed around telecoms, and, you know, for example, a lot of the video conferencing services that we use today, a lot of the software that they use is open source, and a significant parts of that we would have contributed to, you know, and a lot of the sort of platforms that are running these days, and nearly all platforms are IP telephony based. We would have contributed quite a lot to this actual open source software.
Open source simply means anyone can access it and work on it, and it's free to use.
Yeah, yeah. Now, typically, you still need to have considerable technical skills in order to operate it, manage it, et cetera, and implement it. But theoretically, the platform is there. And of course, I suppose Microsoft, one of the biggest users and active agents in open source software these days, which is a massive change from where they would have come from. But that's how prevalent it is. Almost nothing would be able to be built these days, or we wouldn't have anything near the sort of level of cloud-based software services we have today without open source software. So yeah, so we would have contributed quite a lot to it. Aaron still has had a few projects in open source software. He still gets calls from a very large multinational telecoms company asking him if he can make a few updates to some of the code he wrote from many years
ago.
So, yeah, it's gas.
So what happened then? You sold out, you know, Blueface sold.
Yeah.
Like where did that leave you, I guess, in terms of, were you comfortable or could you have retired, or what was it like for you then? What was life like the next day?
It's a funny feeling, actually. So I've spoken to a number of people about this, and the day you sell your company, people are thinking of, yo, hey, this is brilliant and all the rest of it. But you're actually, there's a sort of, somewhat circumspect about it and philosophical about it, because you've spent a significant amount of time. In my case, I spent like 14 years of my life, and the first 6 years sort of 20 hours a day working on this. And I was very proud of it and proud of all the things we'd have achieved and everything else. But in a way, it's still kind of sad. It was great that it was acquired by such an amazing company as Comcast, you know, which is just fantastic. It's a dream come true. So yeah, I could have, you know, I suppose, kicked back and done nothing. But I realized that pretty much the next day after I worked for a year after the deal happened anyway, but day 366, I found myself sitting at a desk, you know, kind of working away.
Because muscle memory just kicked in.
Yeah, you kind of have stuff to do. There's, you know, as you get older and your life becomes more complex in many ways, you know, you've got things going on everywhere. You're busy anyway. There's a certain amount of your day, maybe an hour or two a day, that you require for your own personal administrative stuff, apart from anything else.
Yeah, life admin. It's real.
Yeah, life admin is a thing. So yeah, I had that, and we had a few other ideas about things. So Alan, who came into Blueface in 2011, or I think 2010, 2011, and at that point, you know, we'd kind of grown really fast. We'd, you know, 20 odd people, a couple of million in revenue, but we needed to get to the next stage. And Alan came in; it was fantastic. New management team, some new investment, and Alan had wanted to set up a investment company, and myself and a couple of others worked with him on that. So we set up a company called Venture Wave Capital with the goal of developing an impact investment fund, which would invest in companies which do well by doing good in the areas of clean tech, education, healthcare, and food and agriculture, with this sort of triple bottom line where they would be profitable. We'd invest in them to scale internationally or to bring international businesses to Ireland to use as a headquarters and a scaling launch pad, that they would have a positive impact on the environment and on the world we live in, and that they would bring jobs, taxation, revenue to the country, to Ireland. So this kind of triple bottom line effect was the sort of ultimate
goal. I like that phrase. I've never heard that before.
The triple bottom line, yeah.
Is that trademark?
No, it's open source.
Okay. You're going to hear me quoting that now in loads of different interviews.
Yeah,
triple bottom line really is what it's all about.
Yeah, well, I'm sure I've stolen it from somebody. So, you know, good artists paint, great artists steal and all that. So we set that up with myself and Alan and Kieran, got it underway. And lockdown had just happened, and so I was kind of heavily involved in developing the sort of the impact investment thesis and the impact assessment, and how we reported on it, etc., the fundraising and so on. So that was fine, looking at companies, evaluating them for investment and whether or not they'd fit the thesis. But it wasn't something that I definitely wanted to do full time. You know, I'm an entrepreneur, and I wanted to build stuff. you know, actually so build
why did
it myself.
You do you
know?
It? What so, drives well, you to well, set that up?
I like the idea because I, from a I suppose a patriotic point of view, there's lots and lots of things which are great about Ireland, and there's lots and lots of things which I'd like to change. And I think one of the things that we need to change is our sort of long-term investment focus, you know, in particular around infrastructure, et cetera. You know, there's a sort of veneer of first world around Ireland, but, you know, underneath the covers, we haven't actually invested sufficiently in core infrastructure. And by core infrastructure, I mean the stuff that we're relying on from the British from 100 years ago, like plumbing, you know, sewage, waterworks, roads, railways, you know, that kind of stuff we really haven't focused enough attention on. But at a sort of an economic point of view, I think relying on the foreign direct investment in the long term is probably not going to be sustainable. And so we need to foster a much better culture of entrepreneurship and growing indigenous Irish companies and encouraging them to scale. And, you know, organizations like Enterprise Ireland are absolutely amazing at it. They were incredibly supportive of Blueface and New Business Now as well. But, you know, entrepreneurs need to step up to the plate as well. And we all need to step up to the plate about, well, look, you know, how do we view this? What's our strategy? We don't need a sort of 3-year strategy. We need a 10-year, 20-year strategy.
It's like the 100 years. I think it's Japan, is it? 100-year strategy?
That's what you need.
Like
you
know? This is exactly what I think as well in terms of the Irish entrepreneurship scene. Number one, it's super new. Mm. I remember 10, 15 years ago, there was very few people you could point to and go, that person is a success. They have done what I want to do. I see the path. I think you have to see it to be able to do it sometimes.
Yeah.
It takes you 10 times as long if you can't see it or do it.
That's right.
Really believe that. Yeah, we'd very few people. And that's why I like doing this podcast is that I want to show people like there's hundreds of Irish entrepreneurs that you can look towards and emulate, because I listen to all the San Francisco podcasts. Can't relate to that.
Yeah.
Oh, we did a quick round of 100 million. Come on.
Yeah,
you know, we don't have that scale, but we talked about this over breakfast. How do you turn your weakness into a positive?
Mm.
So what are the key things you would do?
Yeah. Oh, well, I mean, I think a lot
you've
of
got
them,
the platform. You've just been elected dictator of Ireland. You can do whatever you want. Not a democracy anymore. We live in your world. What are we going
to
do?
I think on the economic front, you know, that the infrastructure, I'd probably leave to other people to focus on, but I'm originally a mechanical engineer. I like infrastructure.
I kind of like building
stuff, you know. So yeah, railways all over the country and, you know, anyway. But from an economic point of view, a lot of the entrepreneurs, the really, really successful ones, are incredibly supportive and nobody knows it, you know. And I mean, I'm not going to call them out, but some of the really, really famous entrepreneurs in Ireland who helped me personally, and I know they've helped lots of other business, they're already helping and do a lot for fostering entrepreneurship in
There's
Ireland.
Almost, you know, it's hard that they can't talk about it because it's almost this kind of big grudgery, I'd almost call it, just to put a little label on it. I think there's an element of, he's done well, who do you think he is? He did this, but he didn't do that. He didn't do this, but he didn't do that.
Yeah, there's a little bit of that, I think.
More transparency there.
Yeah, there's a little bit of that, I think. But I think a lot more sort of joined up thinking. So, and I think that 50-year plan that we discussed, that's a fundamental part of it. So if you take an example, almost all successful economies were built around protectionism, you know, where they developed an indigenous industry, you know, be it cars, be it, you know, machinery, whatever it was, you know, and that was protected and you couldn't import them from anywhere else. So they'd have a major public project, be it building roads, building bridges, building trains, and they built them in the country and they're the only ones who could supply it. You know, so we've got a fantastic image as a country of this, you know, green, you know, sustainable, beautiful country with a fantastic agricultural output. But, you know, do we leverage that enough? I know lots of people are trying and on board Bia and everybody else are doing it. But, you know, should we be focusing on sustainable agriculture instead of having, you know, 250,000 cattle, you know, bred for producing beef to turn into hamburgers? Should we produce, you know, 5,000 of the highest quality grass-fed, ecologically, environmentally friendly cattle that there is? You know,
Wagyu beef is a perfect example.
Yeah,
everyone knows what that.
Exactly. You know, if you look at Echirey butter, for example, there's a little place in France, Echirey, it's really, really famous.
Okay.
And it's a beautiful sort of butter and all the rest of it, but it's 5 times the price of your Kerrygold or whatever it is. You know, like, sorry, this is a country where it rains almost everywhere, every day. It's one of the greenest countries on the planet. cattle here eat grass all year round. Why aren't we doing something about that? So if you have a joined up strategy around, okay, this is our agricultural strategy, this is what we're going to produce, this is what we need in order to do it, these are the grants and the incentives we're going to put in place for indigenous companies to supply into these areas. You know, we are getting there, we are starting to do it, but that's the kind of thinking I think we need to have around the next 25, 50 years.
I think it goes back to your original point about the triple bottom line. Grants to what end? Grants to an end of profitability, not grants that make farmers reliant on X crop. Grants gone, crop's no good no more. Now we change strategy again.
Yeah. And strategy is a long-term thing. So you don't really change strategy.
Well, it takes so long to educate people on one thing. Yeah. People think, oh, well, just you see these all the time, these new initiatives and these new things, this new thing. And you're like, okay, well, give that 5-10 years and it might have an impact.
Yeah. So you kind of need to look at the country. Okay, what are our strengths? What are our weaknesses? How do we turn the weaknesses into strengths? You know, what does the country look like in 25 years and in 50 years? You know, how many people are we going to have in the country? Is it 6 million? We can't, you know, at the moment, we can't have 6 million people. So is the country full? You know, should we stop attracting businesses to Ireland because there's nowhere to put people? You know, should we? You know, when you look around, we're in, as we talked about earlier, we're in George and Dublin at the moment, beautiful facades, all the rest of it, the city's flat, there's nowhere to live. And yet you look up at every single Georgian building around the city and you'll have dust, cobwebs, they're not used. Why can't you turn them into residential housing? Georgian offices are typically rubbish as offices, you know, for most purposes. Why aren't they housing?
You said, you know, hit the nail on the head, facades.
You know, yeah.
They're facades. Yeah, they're beautiful. They're like movie sets.
Yeah,
the front is beautiful. Absolutely, fucking awful.
And if you've got a whole pile of cash and, you know, you've nothing better to do, you can restore them and they look fantastic. But I'm sorry, 99% of the population don't have the money to restore a Georgian building and fit it out. They just want somewhere to live. So you can do it, you know, you can draw up a plan with, okay, these are all the Georgian buildings. This is how we'll turn them into apartments. These are the incentives we'll provide. These are the materials we'll use. These are the companies that can provide it. They're all Irish. They'll create jobs. This is a big, you know, that's a way of going, having a joined up policy and transforming from where we are now to having an extra 100,000 apartments in Dublin or 200,000, whatever it is. And that's probably the number, incidentally, and it's achievable within 3 to 5 years.
Yeah.
It's straightforward. Offices, you know, you've purpose-built offices been built all over Dublin and Cork and Limerick and Galway, etc. They're great as offices. These buildings are terrible as offices, you know, for anyone who's actually ever worked in them.
COVID might be the prompt for that, because going to be a draw out of cities in terms of, like, less offices are going to be required. The ones that are required are probably going to be those high-end ones that we talked about.
Yeah.
So what do you do with all the old stock?
With flexible working, you know, typically an office now with 150, 200 people capacity, you know, they've got lockers, they've got hot desking, so people come in, take their laptop out of the locker, put it at a free desk, work away, go home, leaving the laptop in the locker. You know, you don't need 200 fixed desks for 200 specific people. You only need probably 100 because they only ever come in that amount. So yeah, so the whole of Dublin, you know, really the traditional city centre, that should be a vibrant residential area with people living in it, you know, and maybe working in purpose-built offices. But we need a strategic plan to move from where we are now with this hodgepodge of some are offices, some are studios, some are people might live in one corner of them.
And it's kind of hush-hush. It's kind of like, oh, don't talk about it. Jimmy lives up in the studio, but he hasn't got the fire permit, blah, blah, blah.
Exactly. And the top two floors actually we use for storage. You know, there's, 100 square metres in every single one of them. There's a couple of thousand of them, but we're not going to use them because it's too hard and nobody's talking.
Even off Grafton Street, if you go down any of the streets off Grafton Street, South Hand Street, any of those streets, beautiful buildings, and then you look upstairs and you're like, they're all empty.
I'll look at them. Yeah, every single, you'll find, you know, advertising material from 25 years ago stuck in the window with cobwebs on it. Yeah, it's everywhere. So, yeah.
So when you, were you ever tempted to retire after Blueface? Were you ever kind of going, oh, that's me done?
No. I think I've too much energy to do that. The concept of retired, I like, you have to keep busy, you have to be doing stuff, you know, and it's not like it's, life is absolutely fantastic and you have no problems or all the, like, everyone has problems, they're just different kind of problems and everyone has them and you get, that's life for you. So you gotta have a focus, have something you need to have a focus to which you put your creative output. So I'm a kind of a creative person. I think a lot. I imagine a lot. I sort of theorize and wonder, and I'm curious, and what happens if you do this? Does it happen again? Does it happen again? Does it happen every time? And then I get really annoyed when stuff doesn't work. So we're talking about the product-led companies, and it's something that I think we're beginning to focus on in Ireland. We hired, in the new business, we hired a guy, he's actually from Uruguay, and he's a product guy in the sense that all he does is ask questions, and he drive you to distraction about, well, you know, this is your mug. Okay, well, how do you use the mug? Well, do you pick it up like this, or do you like do it like this? And do you always put it there? And does it leak? And, you know, what do you put in it? And does it stain? And how do you wash it? And what color is it? And why do you hold it with this hand and not with this hand? And he knows, wants to know every single detail about how you use something. And it's only when you start doing that. And we kind of did it heuristically, if you know what I mean, and intuitively over the years, yeah, in Blueface and so on. So we, okay, well, how are you using the phone? Okay, well, I think we got it now. Yeah, that's fine. But we never really studied it. And a friend
you
of mine,
you have to be obsessed.
Yeah, you have to be obsessed with it. A friend of mine, he's Japanese, and he worked with Bain and Company, and told me one day they were doing a project for a supermarket, and he went into the supermarket for a week and sat at the frozen food aisle and just basically sat there noting down how everybody opened and closed, yeah, the fridge, or what they picked and so on. And that's how obsessive you have to be about it. So people are starting to get there, but there's not a lot of those kind of product people in Ireland, and not a lot of people with experience, you know. So you need to do that, and I'm like that. So when I see a problem, you know, it drives me crazy, and I need to fix it. And that's kind of how Blueface came around. And that's kind of how our new business, myself and Aaron, have set up this new business, which is effectively like a software bank. It's not a bank, just to be clear. We're not allowed to call it a bank.
The regulator, it's fine. Don't be listening if you're the regulator. Yeah. Turn off here.
Yeah.
Earmuffs.
Incidentally, the regulator is absolutely right. You have to be very clear that it's not a bank, because it's not. But it's like a bank, and it's
I can't believe it's not butter.
Yes, exactly.
I can't believe it's not a bank.
Yeah. Although if you taste it, it's definitely not butter. So it's a software bank in the sense that that's where it wants to be. So, you know, a current account for a business is something which is you access through internet banking. That's your portal into your finances. And it's completely detached from your accounting system and your invoicing system, and your stock management system, or your ERP. So it's a little bit better now with the advent of open banking, which is this sort of EU-UK initiative to open up banking back office systems for third-party platforms to access. So you can, you know, you can suck in your current account data into your accounting platform, but it's still a bit clunky. You know, have to push a button, pull it in, and start reconciling. And the sort of question we started asking was, well, why should your accounting platform and your current account be different? Why wouldn't they be the same thing? Like, it doesn't really make sense to have something which manages the money and then something else which kind of manages the money. They both do more or less the same thing. Like, they all, you know, the transactions come in and out of your bank account, and then you have to switch out of that and go over to your accounting platform and start marking them up. So we wanted a way to integrate that much more closely. We were really fed up with the sort of payments experience. So credit cards are fantastic. Everyone has them. They're really useful. Tap, go, brilliant. Love that. Fantastic. I have an Irish credit card. I live in Madrid sometimes. And basically, in Spain, a non-Spanish credit card won't work online.
In what way do you mean?
Because there's so much fraud that they've just decided, most companies have decided, well, if the card isn't issued in Spain, right, we're not accepting it.
Okay, so where does that stop you using it then?
Well, anywhere in Spain. So for example,
not just online, anywhere.
Well, pretty well.
You tap in the cafe.
Yeah, and then so what's happened was the EU cards, if you remember back in the day, you had this swipe machine. You put the card in, three,
sign
four pieces
it,
of paper, roll the thing across, put in the amount, signed it, and sent it back. That was obviously open to widespread fraud. So in the US, they didn't really introduce chip and PIN. In Europe, they introduced chip and PIN. So that cut out a lot of the point of sale fraud, you know. But what was happening online was that the fraud online wasn't being addressed. And it was a huge, huge problem. And it's a real barrier to the growth of e-commerce, because businesses are quite rightly worried that, oh, well, hang on a second. If I sell online, what happens? You know, I send the product out, I get the receipt from the card payment, and then there's a charge back, or it turns out to be a fraud. This is a big, big problem. So the EU introduced this idea of secure customer authentication, where you had to have some other device or something, you know, about the person that you have to have. So, for example, it's implemented on the app. So you go in, you put your card details in, you press pay, confirm in your app.
I had this problem. I was trying to book a table for us in house. House use OpenTable. There's no charge, obviously, to book a table, but you need a card to reserve it. So I booked table for us. Okay, 9:30, in-house, grand. Okay, now go to your bank and approve the transaction for 000.
Yeah.
Open up the phone.
Yeah.
Transaction goes through. I had to do it again. Do it 3 times for 0 transaction.
Yeah.
And it was only last night.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's bonkers.
It is bonkers.
And I get it. Yeah. I understand.
Yes, absolutely.
Fraud is a massive problem. But I think sub 100 euros, what do we do?
Well, this is the thing. And there's a lot of this. And it's nobody's fault in particular. This is just, you know, the internet has taken off. E-commerce has taken off. We've got this fantastic payment system. We've got cars. They're really great. But hang on, how do we implement it online? So we're really frustrated about that. We're frustrated about the merchant experience, about, you know, the things like the chargebacks and other stuff, and how can we improve that? How can we make it easier for people to pay? And when a business sends out an invoice to another business, why aren't they getting paid as fast as they can? What about the bank transfers? Well, to do a bank transfer, what do I have to do? So I get my invoice. Okay, so I'm paying yourself. Okay, the invoice number is here. So I go into internet banking. I get out my device. Now I've logged into my internet banking. Now I have to set up a new payee. This is your name. This is your address. I probably make a typo. I put in the IBAN. Maybe I make a typo again. I authorize it, go to my device, access that, authorize it, okay. 10 minutes later, you've set up the payee and you're ready to pay the invoice. Now I go in, okay, new payment, go into this person. Where's the reference? The reference is down here. The company's up here. The amount is down. You know, it's really difficult to make a payment. And then, you know.
And it's often just for maybe 100 euros, 200 euros. Yeah.
It could be very large. And so you send out the invoice. Is it paid? Well, I don't know. Let's check internet banking. So check internet banking, and you've sent out 1,000 invoices, and every single one of them is for 100 euro. And half the people have forgotten to put the invoice number on it or the reference on it.
Yeah.
Well, who's this payment from? No idea.
Yeah. Businesses, this is a huge thing. I run this monthly group for entrepreneurs, kind of small-sized entrepreneurs. And one of the biggest problems, each month you bring a problem. Mm. What number one thing are you trying to solve? Mm. And we get a group, 12 people together, we try to solve it. Nearly every month, one of the questions is, I'm struggling to get paid because I'm a small business. I have 5 staff. Mm. We're doing work for maybe 5-10 grand. I'm invoicing out 30, 60, 90 days. Big companies will be like, our payments terms are 60 days.
Yeah.
Live with it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. This is a big issue. And some of the problem is down to, well, how easy do you make it to get paid? Because sometimes that isn't easy. And then how do you reconcile those payments coming in? So they're the ones that we want to solve. We want to make it easy to get paid. We want to make it easy to reconcile those payments. So whether those payments are from, you know, residential retail customers or whether it's from other businesses, we want to make it easy, and we want to make it easy to send money. So that's why we decided to create a software platform with a business current account, with access to the international payments networks, with access to card acquiring so you can accept card payments. And then underpinning it all, something that we're building for the future and something that Aaron got involved with probably 5 or 6 years ago, we like a technology called Bitcoin Lightning. So everyone's heard about Bitcoin. It's, oh my God, it's Bitcoin. It's a scam. It's, you know, the technology.
I'm bullish. Don't worry.
Well, we like the Bitcoin technology in particular. And Bitcoin Lightning is a payments network, and it's designed specifically for payments online. Trustless, decentralized, irrevocable, instant, low cost. It's absolutely beautiful. The technology is amazing. It was developed by MIT, and it was built in order to take advantage of the Bitcoin core of Bitcoin itself, that technology, which is not good for making payments, in particular small payments. So they developed it to use on the internet, and there's a course available online by MIT Labs. There's 17 lectures. It's Cryptocurrency Engineering 101, and it's all about Bitcoin Lightning. It's the introduction to it. And I would suggest it's required watching and listening and learning for anyone interested in payments and what are the problems. Because the problems are one of who is the person paying me? I don't know who they are. Who am I paying? I don't know who they are. So it's an identity problem. It's a trust problem. And how do you solve that on an online world? And Bitcoin Lightning is the solution to it. And it's fantastic how it works. So we believe in that. We kind of bake that in. So in the future, and it's starting now, we're starting to see a few companies adopt it. You can pay with Bitcoin Lightning. But you don't know you're paying with Bitcoin Lightning. So
I think that's the key to crypto adoption.
10 euros. Yeah, 10 euros. Scan the QR code, opens up your wallet. You're paying 10 euros. Scan. What happens in the background might be over Bitcoin Lightning, but all you know is it's 10 euros and the other person gets 10 euros. And that's how it works.
I had this debate with someone a few months ago. They're like, oh, crypto, I don't believe in it, blah, 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 and digital money. I was like, you got any cash on you? Mm. No. What do you use then? My cards. Who are your cards? On my phone. So everything is digital. Yeah. Is that not digital money? Like, we're there, but people don't realize we're there.
Yeah. And it's just a question that it's actually the transport is
it's
the issue.
It's the branding. Branding in people's heads.
Yeah.
Oh, is it by AIB?
Yeah, exactly.
That's going away very quickly. The next gen won't give a damn whether it's PTSB, Revolut, Starling, N26.
Yeah.
No one cares.
The
is the money there? Is it not?
Is exactly. The issue is about value transfer and trust. And whether or not the money's arrived or not arrived. That's what the technology is. Nobody really cares.
Doesn't matter. Do you know how to strip the engine in your car? No.
Not clear.
You drive it though.
Yeah, exactly.
That's how you need to think about it. It's working, it's not working.
Yeah. And that's what we need to focus on. So what we're building in No Friction, and No Friction is the name of the company, we're providing a business current account, which connects up to your ERP or your accounting platform, synchronizes your transactions, automatically reconciles them. We enable you to accept card payments. And then we enable what's called open banking, which I mentioned earlier. So open banking was an EU and UK initiative to develop an alternative means of accessing banking information. So let's say you're going for a loan, you know, as an individual, and you apply to a company and they say, well, we'd like to access your bank records. Instead of you printing off the statement, they will send you a request. You log into your internet banking, your own internet banking, and you see this company wants to access your bank records, your bank statements electronically. You authorize it, and then they can actually download your transactions directly, analyze them, credit score you, give you the loan. That's how it works. Mm. That's typically open banking on one hand. And then the other one is to enable the same thing, but for payments. So you go to your checkout, you add your new bicycle. You go to checkout, you can pay by card or you can pay by bank. And in the past, pay by bank meant, oh, hang on a second, does that mean like I've got to write down the details, go into internet banking,
we want immediacy.
Type them all in.
We want instant.
Yeah, 3 days later, have you received a payment? I don't know, when did you send it? Did you put it around?
Which bank was it? Oh, I'm not with them, it'll be an extra. Yeah, oh, don't process on a Friday.
Yeah, exactly. So with open banking and pay by bank, or it's called technically payment initiation services, our misfortunate name of PIS. So you go and you pay by bank, you click on it, but your internet banking opens up and the invoice is there in front of you, all the details pre-populated, and you click pay and the funds are transferred in immediately.
Okay.
In Ireland, almost immediately. Takes a couple of hours because for technical reasons.
Okay.
But
that's where it's going.
But the funds are transferred in.
So is this going to replace cards?
Well, I think it's an alternative to cards. Cards are really, really great for in a lot of scenarios, you know, for low value transactions, etc. But for very high value transactions, maybe 5,000, 10,000, 20,000, you know, buying a car or you're buying a holiday or something like that, the fees for pay by bank are typically extremely low. Like, so it's just a flat fee.
Okay.
Well, certainly with us, it's a flat fee.
Like, so for businesses,
50 cent a euro.
Yeah.
So instead of, you know, paying 1.5% for your 1,000 euro payment, you're paying maybe 50 cent or a euro, you know, depending on what it was.
Yeah.
And the funds are transferred immediately and you don't have the same issues around chargebacks, et cetera. And then the consumer is covered by the distance selling regulations anyway. So they've got all those rights about how the goods being delivered, et cetera.
Mm. So for businesses, this seems like a very obvious one. If you're a business making regular big payments.
Yeah, it's great. Now, how it's implemented around Europe varies greatly. In the UK, the regulator there imposed a standard on everybody. This is how it has to work. And in the UK and all the UK banks, it works pretty much in the same way and works really, really well. And it's really taking off. And what's coming is variable recurring payments so that you can authorize one and the company can debit them. So it's an alternative to direct debits as well, which is really interesting.
Yeah, makes sense.
In Europe, it's been implemented slightly differently. So it varies. So for example...
It varies.
Yeah. So for example, we have a bunch of merchants using it now. Revolut, people pay with Revolut. Their experience is really, really good. Yeah. So you're on the mobile, you click, oh, pay by bank. The app opens. There's the payment, authorize, face ID, done, transferred.
Done.
Great,
yeah.
Brilliant. Bank of Ireland works really well. Typically, you authenticate it on your mobile. You're making the payment, authenticate, yeah. AIB, for some reason, require a card reader. So you're sitting on the bus, you know, making the payment.
I was trying to find it yesterday, and I was like, it's here somewhere.
Take out your card reader. Oh, yeah, the one I need to go and find.
It took me 20 minutes to find it. I know I'd used it about six months ago. I had to dig it out.
Yeah, I don't know why. Maybe it's an early thing, or maybe it's only some transactions. But it still works. And when it works well. So you have your card into the card reader, authorized, that's fine.
But it's the steps. You have to put in your PIN, then you go sign. Then I have to put the last eight digits of your bank account into it. Then I got to put in the amount. Then I got another eight digit code.
I know the amount of errors and time that takes.
So no friction, bank to bank.
Yeah, so they're bank to bank payments.
Business to business.
Business to business, yeah. It's all our customers are businesses and they're all focused on not saving money. You know, banking isn't expensive. It's really not expensive. It's a pretty low cost thing. What we're focused on is instant transfers, value transfer on the internet, enabling reconciliation, automated reconciliation of your current account and your ERP and accounting platform, making it easy for you to pay and making it easy for you to get paid and reconcile those payments. That's what it's all about. So our goal, I suppose, over the next kind of 5 years is to build that platform out so we are the preferred business current account. Really. So if you want a business current account, use No Friction because you automatically connect it up to your accounting platform. When you want to make a payment, you make it from your accounting platform. You don't create the invoice in your accounting platform and then email the invoice and then the payment comes in and you go to internet banking and then you try and find it and then you update your accounting. You know, that's not how it works.
My VAT from the last quarter is still outstanding for that exact reason because I'm bad at paperwork.
Yeah, and everybody is. And nobody likes it, but it's necessary. And you know why it's necessary. So we need to automate it. So they're a problem that we need our product guy to go, okay, well, exactly how are you doing your VAT? What happens with your VAT? What do you do? What do you make? Like, you know, that's what we need to figure out. And that's what we're doing.
Okay.
So that's No Friction.
I love it. Mm. I want to get some ideas off you because clearly you're filled full of them. I love ideas. We do a whole podcast on a Monday with ideas. Give me some ideas you would pursue if you weren't doing this. If someone's listening here and they're like, I want to start a business 2023. Let's give them some freebies. What trends are you looking at going, yeah, this is going to be good. Or I'd do this if I had the time.
Oh yeah. That's a hard one. Well, there's the big picture ones, you know, self-driving cars, never going to happen for anyone who's driven around Naples. Good luck with the self-driving cars. You know, trips to Mars and all that. I think it's some of the core problems that, you know, face people every day and they're not immediately obvious. And so I'm not going to be able to, you know, just pull out of my head some ideas for a business. But typically, you know, you'd be working in a business and you spend 4 hours of your day working on a particular task and it seems pointless, but it's necessary. How can you improve that? And if you came to the business and said, look, I'll charge you 100 quid a month and you won't have to employ somebody for 4 hours a day every day to do this task, would you pay it? Oh yeah. Well, that's a business. You know, that's really what you want to focus on is, look, here's a problem. It's a real problem. And the problem is big enough and sufficiently large for somebody to pay somebody to fix it for them. Or if they're throwing money at the problem to fix it at the moment, in other words, hiring somebody, employing somebody to do it, how can we solve that in software? And you know the old adage, software eats everything. It really does. I didn't kind of understand that when I first heard it. And now I understand it. Software eats everything. You can automate just about anything you want.
I think we're at a big tipping point here. You know? I think we're at a really, really, really big tipping point in terms of software eating everything. I think it did. Like you talked about the first tech boom. Yes, software was starting to eat everything. Now it really is. You're saying that necessary, but must be done. I was trying to do the stats for this podcast because you need to send them out to advertisers and sponsors, things like that. Yeah. It takes about a half day.
Yeah.
That sounds so ridiculous, right? Because some of them live in this dashboard.
Yes.
And some of them are only pulled for these dates. You can't pull them for that date. You want to do a year. Oh, you can't do that.
Yeah.
And I tweeted out going, oh, this is such a pain.
Yeah.
A young developer got in touch with me. He's like, can I have a call with you? I want to solve this problem. I'm in the middle of building something. I was like, absolutely. And had a call with him. Again, he's product guy, dug deep into it. I chatted him again last week. He goes, we're very, very close to launching this and we've raised X amount. And I was like, there you go. That's what it's all about.
Yeah.
Solve problems. I would pay 50 quid a month for that. Easy.
Perfect.
Yeah. No problem.
Yeah.
Exactly. Because half a day.
Yeah. It's a lot, and it's a your time is worth more than 50 euros half a day.
That's it. You don't have a problem. You have a money problem. Can you afford, what's your hourly rate? I ask every entrepreneur that. They're like, oh, I'm so busy. I'm so busy.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's your hourly rate?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's exactly it. And you know, oh, I need to do X, Y, and Z. Are you sure? Can you not get somebody else to do that? Wouldn't it be great, you know, the whole thing about ChatGPT and you know, the AI powered conversation skills, and wouldn't it be great if you go to it and say, listen, I need my statistics. Here's my statistics, here's my this dashboard, this is what I need, solve it, boom. But yeah, that'd be cool.
Well, this guy is very close to that. It's literally take a screenshot of it, it'll pull it, hourly, daily, weekly, whatever you want.
There you go.
Create a dashboard in Notion. I love Notion. I think it's great. Very, very very close to, we'll all have a homepage, I think.
Yeah,
I think that's my thesis now, is we'll all have a homepage internally for what we want to do. A second brain,
our
that concept.
Our to-do list and our whiteboarding.
I'm a massive nerd for that sort of stuff. So I've everything in Notion, and I'm trying to like connect everything, but it's quite laborious. I'm kind of updating it every day, whereas he's very close to developing this thing whereby it's just a screenshot, bang, done, updates automatically.
Yeah.
So solve a problem. That's kind of the gist of it.
That's the only advice. I couldn't pick something out of it. I have some pet hates I don't like. I'll tell you what I really hate, actually, to be honest with you. Tickets. Ticketing.
Okay.
So you go to U2 announced concert next year. Not necessarily U2. Maybe it's Coldplay, whoever it happens to be. Okay, tickets are announced. There's only one place you can buy the tickets. Really? Although not a lot of people know this, apparently you can buy them at the actual venue. The actual venue.
If you go there.
If you physically go there. Mm. Apparently they have some tickets. But anyway, you go to the platform, and I'm not going to mention it. You go to the platform.
They're going to pay for advertising on this podcast.
and the tickets are gone.
Yeah.
You know, and you might be waiting for, you know, there's people around the world spending a whole day logged in trying to wait for a ticket. Yeah. Tickets are all gone. Next day, they're on another platform and they've been sold for 10 times the price. And that platform is owned by the same company.
Mm. It's a little bit inside baseball. Yeah.
Sorry? You know, everyone loves a great business. But that's not that's
and they've been regulated now. I think that's why they bought that other business, because they're getting regulated. They're going, these.
Now look, I've no beef with that particular company or any other companies that are involved in it. And the concept of being able to sell your tickets that you don't want is great, you know. But you know, you want to go to, let's say, the World Cup final. You know, you've followed Leo Messi since, you know, he was 14 years old. You know, you've saved up all your pocket money and you want to go to the World Cup final, but you can't because somebody's selling the tickets for, you know, 15,000 euros.
Yeah.
You know, or you want to go and see your favorite band, but you can't because you're 17 and you've got like 50 quid that you've earned, but the tickets are now 500. Like, that's wrong, you know.
Man United are doing a good thing on this in terms of season tickets and tickets. Obviously, it's very hard to get tickets for them. So I was like on a waiting list for years.
It is now.
It is. Look, we are back, right? Anyway, I'll ignore that jibe. We're back, right? I've been on a waiting list for years for season tickets. This was on my bucket list.
Yeah.
And last season, they were like, oh, we're doing this thing called cup season tickets.
Right.
You can get tickets staying in the cups. But what they can do is, if you can't make it, as long as you have a Man United membership, you can forward that to them.
Mm.
So for the face value, you can just transfer them. So I can say, Fergal, I can't make it on Saturday. Do you want to go?
Yes.
That's, and I can forward it to you. 50 quid to me.
Yeah.
Forward it to you.
Yeah.
Happy days. Because then you're keeping it within a closed ecosystem. There's no head the ball is going to streak onto the pitch.
Yeah.
I thought that was brilliant.
It is brilliant.
Because it comes back to incentives.
Yeah.
the very thing we talked about in terms of the property, in terms of business, are people incentivized in a good way? Don't penalize people because people, humans will always find a way around.
Yeah.
We love a find a way around things. Yeah. Incentivize. Make it simple.
Exactly.
I can transfer it to you. Yeah, no bother. You head off there
Friday.
That's
a great idea. I didn't know that. That's the way it should work.
Exactly.
That's exactly
because I was like, season ticket, I'm not going to be able to go all the time. It's going to be a massive waste. I'm only going to want to go five times of the year. They're like, no, you can transfer them within the ecosystem. And it's really simple. Yeah. You know, I'd have the dashboard, your online tickets. You can click, you know, add to wallet or forward to a member.
That's brilliant. Yeah, that's a great idea. Yeah. And I think, you know, that's the way it should work. So I'm delighted to hear that now. Yeah.
So what does the next 18 months hold for you?
So it's very exciting.
A lot of travel.
Yeah. Well, not so much travel.
I'm going to put commuting in inverted brackets for you.
Yeah. We're going through the whole regulatory process, the central bank. It's very exciting. Really, really interesting. We're doing that. We've got some plans to grow and expand from, you know, we've got customers in Ireland, Portugal, Belgium, UK, Spain at the moment. So we're growing quite rapidly from a sales point of view. We got some exciting developments on the product front, and we just want to keep adding functionality and working on sort of our integrations and making it easier and easier to do all of this admin stuff in the background so you can focus on, you know, doing what you want to do, not administration and internet banking and accounting platforms. So we've got a lot of stuff going on with that. So I think 18 months time, it'd be great to come back and tell you all about it.
We'll do it in Madrid or Portugal?
You can do it in Madrid. Do it in Madrid. That's, Madrid would be great.
I'm putting that in the diary. That's happening, right?
Make sure there's a game in the Bernabeu.
100%.
Or out with Atleti. I kind of like Atleti, actually.
Lifestyle design. That's what I'm all about this year. That's my new buzzword.
Yeah.
Have you got a book you recommend to people?
It
can be personal, professional, or you just enjoyed it.
I like, one of my favorite books is The Elements of Eloquence.
I'm going to hit the new buzzer klaxon the new book klaxon. We've never heard of that.
Okay, The Elements of Eloquence by Mark Forsyth.
The Elements
of Eloquence.
Eloquence. And ironically, that the name is hard to say.
Yes. Well, it's all about how to use words. How to use words and how powerful they are and how we've lost. It used to be a subject that was taught extensively. Like, so for example, Shakespeare probably would have gone through, how to use words, oratory, how to use words, how to win arguments, how to persuade people, how to use words and in what context and subject. It starts off really interestingly because it talks about Shakespeare and it talks about, Cleopatra and her sailing down the river on the barge, and the barge was burnished gold, and the whole scene is laid with the Queen Cleopatra coming down the Nile on the barge, and this is, you know, from Shakespeare's writings. But what Forsyth points out is that Shakespeare he wrote it, but it wasn't his idea, because there was a contemporary of his who had a very, very similar play and with the exact same scene. And he actually has an extract of the identical scene written by the other guy. And it's the exact same thing. In other words, he's saying there is no way that Shakespeare did not have this book open on his desk at the time. And what he simply did was he did it better than the other guy. You know, and that's how it, so that's a little taster of it. It's absolutely fascinating. And what's really fascinating is that we get an insight. We're looking into the greatest English language writer, possibly one of the greatest writers in any language, how he worked.
Okay.
Right there, you're staring back into the past, looking at a guy with his quill pen, looking at this book going, geez, I need some ideas. Oh, hang on a second. Here's one.
Comes back to your great artists, good artists.
Yeah. Exactly. It's fascinating. And it's a beautiful, beautiful book for anyone who enjoys language.
That's going in the basket today. I'm going to get that.
Yeah,
I could really do a bit more eloquence in my life.
Yeah.
Where can people learn more about yourself and No Friction?
Nofriction.com. And I suppose on LinkedIn, Fergal Brady.
Perfect. Fergal, been an absolute pleasure. See you in 18 months in Madrid.
That'd be great. Looking forward to it. Bernabeu.
Everybody, hope you enjoyed today's episode with Fergal. Wherever you're listening, whether it's Spotify, YouTube, or Apple, hit the subscribe button. I'll see you back here next Monday for a brand new episode. See you then.